Donald Trump has his eyes set on Greenland.
The Prime Minister of Denmark has said it's absolutely out of the question.
The French military is pulling out of West African countries.
Public opinion in West Africa has become critical of French and Western military presence in the region.
And Meta plans to stop fact-checking.
It's really going to be much more of an unregulated, wide-ranging kind of place for content.
Today is Wednesday, January 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Alexis Strobe.
And I'm Steve Karish. We'll start off today in Florida at Mar-a-Lago, the home of President-elect Donald Trump, who held a press conference Tuesday that covered a wide range of topics. I spoke with our White House bureau chief, Patsy Wita-Kuswara, for the details.
Yeah, so this is billionaire Hussein Tajwani, who's the chairman of Dubai-based developer Damat Properties. He said he's investing $20 billion in the U.S. to support new data centers in various states. These are physical locations to store computer processing and memory that's needed to power AI. Tajwani has known Trump for some years. He spent his New Year's Eve celebrating at Mar-a-Lago. So this is, again, an indicator of how important personal connections between Trump and his billionaire friends are in conducting business. Last month, Trump conducted a similar press conference alongside this Japanese billionaire Masayoshi Son, who also announced a $100 billion investment in the U.S., also focused on AI.
So ordinarily, a large investment like that in American technological infrastructure would be the top story coming from the press conference. But of course, this is Donald Trump, and he said a couple other things that sort of grabbed the headlines away from him. Can you tell us what happened next? What did he say about Greenland and the Panama Canal that has everybody very concerned?
Well, this was something that he has floated for some weeks now, some months even. But this is the first time that he has said more specifically about his plans to take control of Greenland and Panama Canal. He was asked by a reporter if he can assure that he would not use economic and military coercion to do so. And he basically said no. He said he is not ruling out using tariffs, even military force, because he said that it was a matter of national security. He has said that he would apply a very high-level tariff on Denmark. As we know, Greenland is an autonomous part of the Kingdom of Denmark. And since 1941, the U.S. has maintained this military base there. But Danish Prime Minister Mette Frederiksen has repeatedly said that Greenland is not for sale. And she said it again today as the president-elect's son, Donald Trump Jr., came for a surprise visit to Greenland.
You mentioned the U.S. has a large base on Greenland as it is. Why does Trump feel the U.S. needs to possess Greenland? Did he say?
Yeah, well, he basically said that the U.S. needs Greenland for national security purpose. He questioned whether Denmark has any legal rights to Greenland. But if they do, he said, quote, they should give it up because we need it for national security. He said that he's talking about protecting the free world. He said, you don't even need binoculars. You have China ships, Chinese ships all over the place. You have Russian ships all over the place. Obviously, he means in terms of the geostrategic location of Greenland. So this is some reasoning that he has said that this is why he wants to take over Greenland. But again, the Prime Minister of Denmark has said it's absolutely out of the question. And so has the President of Panama, who just last week celebrated the 25 years of anniversary of the transfer of the canal from the U.S. To Panama, and he has said that we would never change that. And Trump also reiterated threats to absorb Canada, although he ruled out military force in doing so. And the outgoing Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau, said on social media, there isn't a snowball's chance in hell that Canada would become part of the United States.
Turning our attention now to his legal battles, a judge in Florida seemed to side with Trump and not allow Special Prosecutor Jack Smith's report to be released to the public. Did Trump mention what looks like a pretty strong legal victory for him?
Yeah, he was asked that question just minutes or even seconds after the announcement was made, and he welcomed it. He called it great news. He said that if the report was released, it would be, quote, a fake report, just like the investigation was a fake investigation. So he was full form, commented about a lot of things, including his court cases, listed a whole list of grievances, which we've heard before, but also made a lot of news, including on Greenland, on Panama Canal, and also on Canada, as well as the investment, which was, as you said, the initial purpose of the press conference.
We'll leave it there for today. Patsy Wudakuswara, VOA's White House Bureau Chief. Patsy, thanks for your reporting, and I'm sure we'll be talking again shortly.
My pleasure. Thank you.
There's praise as well as criticism for far-right French leader Jean-Marie Le Pen, who died Tuesday at the age of 96. A pugnacious veteran of the colonial wars, Le Pen was a five-time presidential candidate who helped to shape the rising power of Europe's far right. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
Thousands of French demonstrating against Jean-Marie Le Pen in 2002. This is one of the many events that marked the life of the far-right National Front Party founder. That year, Le Pen was second in the first round of French presidential elections, shocking France and the world. Frontrunner and incumbent President Jacques Chirac made an appeal against extremism. It worked. Chirac won the runoff with more than 80% of the vote.
Je ne dis pas que les chambres à gaz n'ont pas existé.
Today, Le Pen's death is drawing a fractured reaction. Members of Le Pen's far-right party, since renamed the National Rally by his daughter Marine, describe him as a courageous visionary who has always served France. Other politicians are less complimentary. Centrist President Emmanuel Macron sent his condolences to Le Pen's family and said Le Pen would be judged by history. Far-left politicians denounced Le Pen for his anti-immigrant, anti-Muslim, anti-Semitic stances. A veteran of two French colonial wars, Le Pen founded the far-right National Front in 1972. His Paris apartment was bombed 4 years later.
Édition spéciale consacrée à la mort de Jean-Marie Le Pen.
Le Pen shocked the nation, still traumatized by its World War II past, by calling Nazi gas chambers a detail in French history. He was later tried and fined. Daughter Marine Le Pen took over the party in 2011. She launched a major makeover to soften its racist image, make it more aligned with common working class issues, and rebranded it as a National Rally Party. The two Le Pens feuded, and in 2015, Jean-Marie Le Pen was ousted from the party he founded. Later, father and daughter drew closer. Analysts say Le Pen has left a broader mark on Europe, seen in the far right's rising influence in places like Austria, Germany, and in France, where the opposition National Rally is now the country's most powerful party. Lisa Bryant, VOA News.
Another story involving France. Ivory Coast and Senegal have announced that France will withdraw its troops from bases in their territories, effectively ending a decades-long military presence. Henry Wilkins looks at what it means for regional security.
A major shift in West Africa's security landscape. Ivory Coast and Senegal, regional economic powerhouses, have ordered France to remove troops from their territories. The withdrawals will mark the effective end of a decades-long military presence by France in Senegal and Ivory Coast. But why is this happening? Geoffrey Julien Kouayo, an Ivorian political scientist, explains it's part of a broader strategy by African nations wanting to forge new partnerships.
Les pays côtiers comme le Sénégal et la Côte d'Ivoire s'inscrivent dans la nouvelle dynamique.
He says he thinks that African politicians want to diversify their relations, especially with the countries of the global south, such as China, Turkey, Brazil, the Arab monarchies of the Gulf, but also with Russia.
Ivory Coast and Senegal are following in the footsteps of Sahel countries that are fighting a war against jihadis linked to Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. After almost 10 years of French military involvement failed to stop escalating terrorist violence in the Sahel, the former colonial power began removing its troops from the region in 2022.
Je pense que les hommes politiques africains veulent diversifier leurs relations.
Kouayo adds, coastal countries like Senegal and Ivory Coast are part of the new dynamic initiated by the Sahel states, such as Burkina Faso, Mali, Niger, and Chad. These countries are looking for more sovereignty, and above all, politicians don't want to go against public opinion, which favours the departure of French troops.
Public opinion in West Africa has become critical of French and Western military presence in the region. Many see it as a continuation of colonial ties. It's even become the source of debunked conspiracy theories that France is supporting terrorist groups. Rinaldo de Pagna, West Africa Project Director for the International Crisis Group, doubts the French military departure will improve security in Senegal and Ivory Coast, which border the Sahel countries and have seen terrorist attacks spilling over from them.
L'expansion du djihadisme dans le nord des pays côtiers est lente.
He says the expansion of jihadism in the north of the coastal countries has been slow, but fairly constant since 2020. He adds that it's not certain the departure of French troops, and more broadly of foreign troops, will make a big difference, except perhaps in terms of information sharing. Asked if Senegal and Ivory Coast could seek military partnerships with Russia, as some Sahel countries have, de Pagna responded,
Mais on se souvient que la présence des troupes françaises au Sahel entre 2013 et 2022
that the presence of French troops in the Sahel between 2013 and 2022 did not restore security. The Russian troops currently engaged in the Sahel haven't done any better, he says. This is largely because the solution to Sahelian armed jihadism is not only military, but also political, he stresses. Analyst Andrew Leibovitch, a research fellow at the Klingendael Institute in the Netherlands, notes that as French troops depart West Africa, France continues to train troops fighting terrorism.
Certainly French troops are going to remain involved in training and cooperation in Côte d'Ivoire, in Benin, likely in a few other places. So it's not an end to the post-colonial military presence, but it certainly is an important shift.
Other Western nations are offering military assistance to coastal West African countries. The US will hold its annual West African military exercise, Flintlock, in Ivory Coast this year. Henry Wilkins, VOA News.
And here are some other stories we're following from around the world.
Jimmy Carter's state funeral moved to Washington after observances in his native Georgia. The 39th president's remains were flown to Washington and taken to the U.S. Navy Memorial. Carter's flag-draped casket was then transferred to a horse-drawn caisson for his final journey to the Capitol, where members of Congress honored Carter in the Capitol Rotunda on Tuesday.
Venezuelan opposition leader Edmundo Gonzalez says his son-in-law has been kidnapped in Venezuela's capital. Gonzalez claims to have defeated President Nicolas Maduro in last year's presidential election. His allegation on Tuesday comes days before Friday's presidential swearing-in ceremony.
Officials say more than 5,600 people were reported killed in Haiti last year as a UN-backed mission led by Kenya struggles to contain rampant gang violence. The UN Human Rights Office said Tuesday that the number of killings increased by more than 20% compared with 2023. The UN said victims include more than 200 people killed in December, this after a gang leader sought to avenge his son's death following voodoo rituals. Was one of the biggest massacres reported in Port-au-Prince in recent history.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish.
President-elect Trump is promising to reverse Biden administration efforts to fight climate change and says he will grow the U.S. economy by drilling for more oil. VOA correspondent Scott Stearns has our story.
Donald Trump campaigned on boosting U.S. fossil fuels.
We will quickly become energy independent, and we will frack, and drill, baby, drill. We're going to drill, baby, drill, and frack.
Joe Biden's administration invested in building out the nation's electric vehicle charging network and worked with congressional Democrats to create a national service program on climate change as part of what Biden called a Green New Deal. Trump says that's a Green New Scam that he will end, along with electric vehicle subsidies and tougher gasoline engine emission standards. In his first term, Trump withdrew from an international climate treaty.
The Paris Climate Accord is simply the latest example of Washington entering into an agreement that disadvantages the United States.
Trump supporters in Congress say his commitment to oil and natural gas in a second term positions U.S. producers to capitalize on growing global energy demands without the limits of climate deals. Those changes may have less of an impact than they would have 10 years ago, says energy analyst Zahra Ahmed.
The president has broad power to repeal through the regulatory process proposed and existing regulations, including for things like power plant emissions of methane, for vehicle emissions as well. However, at the same time, consumers can choose to purchase a low emissions vehicle. States can choose to enact their own regulations about emissions, as we see California do. So again, I think while the federal government is an incredibly powerful tool, it doesn't mean that we're at the end of climate action in the U.S.
The new administration has many reasons to remain engaged on renewable energy.
Most of those battery factories are built out in states with Republican governors, and they don't want those factories unplugged from their economies, and they don't want those workers laid off. They want this prosperity to continue.
Industry analysts say Trump's commitment to deregulating American business may end up helping renewable energy by speeding the permitting of new transmission lines. Scott Stearns, VOA News.
Looking at Asia, the Biden administration on Monday removed obstacles to India's quest for nuclear power, with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan visiting New Delhi and describing the India-U.S. collaboration as crucial for peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific. VOA's White House correspondent Anita Powell asks what lies ahead as Trump returns to the U.S. presidency.
The Biden administration on Monday removed obstacles to India's quest for nuclear power, with U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan visiting New Delhi and describing the India-U.S. collaboration as crucial for peace and stability in the Indo-Pacific. VOA White House correspondent Anita Powell asks what lies ahead for the countries as Donald Trump returns to the U.S. presidency. India's nuclear power ambitions face one fewer obstacle now, said U.S. National Security Advisor Jake Sullivan in New Delhi.
The United States is now finalizing the necessary steps to remove long-standing regulations that have prevented civil nuclear cooperation between India's leading nuclear entities and U.S. companies. The formal paperwork will be done soon, but this will be an opportunity to turn the page on some of the frictions of the past.
Indian liability rules had posed an obstacle to U.S. companies that hoped to build power plants in India, in that they assigned high liability to builders and suppliers of nuclear power plants in case of accidents. President Joe Biden has elevated Washington's relationship with New Delhi, and in September hosted Prime Minister Narendra Modi at his home for the first leaders' gathering of the Quad, four nations poised as a counterweight to Beijing. India watchers in Washington say Sullivan's visit launched key announcements in areas like space cooperation, defense, and more, all meant to build momentum for the next U.S. administration, and to let the outgoing leadership make a point. Rick Rosso is chair on India and Emerging Asia Economics at the Center for Strategic and International Studies.
So I think it really does put a really strong pound point on the fact that India is prioritized there and above a lot of our other partnerships.
And it's a partnership that has grown even amid their differences, like India's continuing ties with Moscow after Russia invaded Ukraine. Rosso listed reasons that he believes security cooperation will stay afloat and cited Trump and Modi's good personal rapport. The tension this time around, he said, will be economic.
You're going to have less cheering for outbound investments, a lot more pressure in India to buy more American goods, whether it's hydrocarbons or defense goods, the things the government of India actually has control of buying. So the economic side is where I'm a little bit more concerned. I think India will fare better than a lot of our major partnerships in the next 4 years.
The two renew this relationship in January. Anita Powell, VOA News, Washington.
On Tuesday, Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Meta, announced changes to content moderation on Facebook and Instagram, long sought by conservatives. The move will replace third-party fact-checking with user-written community notes, similar to those on Trump backer Elon Musk's social platform X. For a look at why this is significant, Steve spoke with Gordon Stables, director of the School of Journalism at the University of Southern California.
I think it's significant because it reflects the way people will get to use and see Meta's platforms, Facebook and specifically, but other platforms overall, in terms of it's really going to be much more of an unregulated, wide-ranging kind of place for content, closer to what we now see on Twitter X.
Well, if one of the arguments that Meta is making is that it's freedom of speech, you should be allowed to say what you want. Does that ring true?
Well, there's certainly an element of freedom of speech, but I think the way that I try to teach it for my students is there's the freedom of speech for individuals and there's the freedom of speech in the marketplace. And it's a question of what kind of marketplaces do we have, and what Meta is saying that their marketplaces will be much more of where anyone can say virtually anything. And then it's up to individuals to decide if that's the kind of marketplace that you want to be a part of.
Now, I think to some extent, right, the freedom of speech has always been unregulated, right? The marketplace of ideas, going back even farther, where I could take my soapbox and go to the town square and say whatever I wanted to. So how is this different?
It's really about volume and amplification. And I think I love that you use the town square example, because really the analogy works as long as you could say, but what happens if someone could show up and their soapbox was 50 feet high? And they had an unlimited number of speakers and a number of limited ways to amplify and repeat their message. That's kind of the analogy, is that our marketplace means that what happens if you live in a space where you can have a lot of really loud, repetitive voices that might be the most extreme voices, but also might be the voices that make the most money. What happens to the town square in that setting?
And what about other media and fact-checking? I mean, here we are on a radio program. I'm not fact-checking you the way Meta had before. Why do we hold internet social media companies to a different standard?
I think the question is, what do we want these platforms to be? And the reason why fact-checking is important is if we think these platforms have journalistic values, if they have an interest in what's true, then what you want is some validity, some validation, some support of that. But I think what the platforms are saying is, we really view ourselves as more as an old bulletin board model, or an old example where anyone can really say anything. And then, but, you know, as Zuckerberg said himself, that means there will be more bad stuff on the platform. The question is that going to be, is it old Times Square or new Times Square? And well, that's a little bit of how people have to think about.
Needless to say, things are changing. You know, the times, they have changed, so to speak. So what is the future of mass communications? Is it going to be privately controlled high-tech platforms? Is it going to be broadcast? Is it going to be user-generated streaming? How does the future play into this? And what role, if any, does the government have in creating a future that works for everybody?
Well, I think the last part of your question is probably the most significant driver, which is governments around the world will dictate, if they choose, what kinds of regulations exist. Like right now, what this really positions is, if you use Meta's platforms in the United States versus if you use Meta's platforms in the European Union, you will have very different experiences of what content you get. And that's what I think you will see lots of communities increasingly make decisions. So, for instance, Meta announced that they're going to have the content moderator, their content moderator folks in Texas. Texas has a law that says you really can't restrict content based on the nature of that content on the platform. Users will decide if that's something that they like, both from an economic decision making, but also from sponsoring with their platforms. And there's lots to be left settled by that. But I do think the question is, you will see different governments decide. And like, you know, TikTok may disappear in another week and a half. And so we'll see in what cases does government regulate and what cases do they not.
And we'll leave it there for today. Gordon Stables is the director of the School of Journalism at the Annenberg School for Communications and Journalism at the University of Southern California. Professor Stables, thanks for your insight. Thanks for your analysis.
Thanks for having me.
And finally today, some sad news. Peter Yarrow, the singer-songwriter best known as one-third of the folk group Peter, Paul, and Mary, died Tuesday in New York. He was 86 years old. Peter, Paul, and Mary's impassioned harmonies transfixed millions since their first record in 1962, as they lifted their voices in favor of civil rights and against war. Yarrow co-wrote Puff the Magic Dragon, which is perhaps their most enduring song.
That'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on The Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us.
For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com.
In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.
Puff the Magic Dragon, lived by the sea and frolicked in the